Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. And welcome once again to another Trademark podcast. My name is Stefan Nurline. I'm joined today by comrades Dr. Sean Byers of our very own Trademark Belfast. I'm really pleased today to welcome Angus Gordon, good friend and comrade, president of the RMT, train driver, trustee of the Marks Memorial Library, and also cyclist. He joined me last year with a group of other people, and they cycled from, it was Belfast, all the way down to Cork to raise money for the Connolly Association, and I joined them for a part of it. And it was done in the memory of our own Mel Corrie. They did it under the banner of the Mel Corrie Brigade. A marvellous and much appreciated gesture. So you're very welcome, Alex.
Lovely to be here. It's nice to see you and Sean.
And today we were thinking last week, me and Sean, about doing this podcast, because in our political schools we always ask punters to talk about neoliberalism. And if they don't know what that word means, because not everyone does, and we ask them to describe Thatcherism and its characteristics. And if they're still a little unsure, we kind of ask them to describe their experiences of the world of work. And that always, of course, leads to discussions around jobs and security and contracts and 0 hours and hire and fire and what capital and its adherence and its bootlickers like to call flexible labour market. And so that's really the subject of today's talk, is the idea of this flexible labour market, a huge subject which we're going to skim over in a very unsatisfactory manner, but we'll start it anyway and we'll have a go. And we've been pushed to have this chat really because, and we're pleased Alex is here in particular, because of the actions of P&O, who sacked 800 workers with no warning a few weeks ago. And to kick us off, I'm going to ask Alex, just so you might want to give us a brief update, Alex, of the situation of those workers in P&O before we kind of delve into the world of work.
Yeah, well, the majority of the, just shy of 800, in the high 700s, workers who were given their marching orders at 0 hours notice, the majority of them have now signed gagging clauses, non-disclosure agreements, which were requirements of the enhanced redundancy payment, which P&O offered in return for those workers waiving their rights to go to an employment tribunal. And it was Hobson's choice, in the sense that the company had priced in the fact that they were flagrantly breaking employment law and were prepared to pay a enhancement, which it wasn't a generous enhancement. It was an enhancement that they would have effectively had to pay anyway if the breach of employment law had been priced into a claim for unfair dismissal. So apart from a small number of the sacked P&O workers, they're mostly now looking for work elsewhere in the ferry sector. But the other part of your question was what's happened to P&O. And what's happened to P&O is that it's teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. Now, it claimed erroneously prior to the redundancies that they were losing hundreds of millions of pounds a year. Although given that we've just been through COVID and that the market is, you know, in a great deal of flux due to Britain leaving the European Union and other issues, clearly it was an excuse that they were using, or an attempted justification for their decision to dismiss 800 members of staff and employ workers at rates of £1.81 an hour in place of workers who were on union negotiated paying conditions. But what's happened to P&O since they dismissed those 800 workers is that their ships are still tied up in port, and you'll see them in Larne Harbour.
When we were there, you pointed at it. We were at the demo in Larne. You pointed at it and you said there's a good chance that ferry won't leave this port.
Yeah, the European Causeway is still sitting there in Larne Harbour, and it's been detained by the Maritime Coast Guard Agency over maritime safety concerns. And effectively, that's happened to several of the other vessels that P&O run their ferry services with as well. So the ferry company P&O runs services between Larne and Cairn Ryan. It has slots between Liverpool and Belfast. It also has Hull to Hook of Holland and Rotterdam. And it's the largest part, however, of its business is the busiest between Dover and Calais. And in Dover and Calais, they're still not running services.
One of the things that strikes me as amazing in this sort of scenario, before we move on, is you'd have thought they would have war gamed this. No, they'd have sat down and thought, right, if we do this, what are the consequences for our company? What are the consequences? And they don't seem to have war gamed it very well.
I think they probably did wargame it and they miscalculated. They thought they were going to be able to do what shipping companies have done in Irish ferries and in the deep sea sector, which is simply to rely on ships officers who would take redundancy, come back as agency labour, run the ship, and then be able to bring in agency workers from India, from Eastern Europe. Their original plan, we know because this has come out in some of the parliamentary inquiries, their original plan was they were going to crew these ships, get this, with Russian officers and Ukrainian ratings. And they sacked the 800 workers on the 17th of March, the St. Patrick's Day massacre, right at the point where a full-scale war was taking place in Ukraine between Russia and Ukrainian forces. So that plan, for they war-gamed it, if you want to use that unfortunate expression, and they got it wrong. They were then thrown onto the global labour market, which is used by most shipping companies to supply labour, not just in engine rooms and navigators and people with particular skills, but also service sector labour. And they haven't been able to bring in those workers because the complexity of trying to run a huge vessel, a floating machine, means that you can't simply replace the entire crew overnight. You have to train them in advance, and you have to have people to, you know, teach the new staff who are coming on board.
Sean, it was shocking, wasn't it? We just said there, Alex, that they've miscalculated. It does seem to be a massive blunder on their part, doesn't it? But I mean, and what was your initial reaction to it when you heard it?
Yeah, I think it's symptomatic of the attitude that's developed within big corporate class and that they're encouraged to do so under national law. So it's clear that, you know, those actions were enabled and encouraged by weaknesses in UK law, just as Irish ferries were able to do under Irish law. I was looking at the British government's proposals, and I'm not an expert in this, but it's clear that they don't go anywhere near far enough to prevent this from happening again. They don't prevent companies from firing workers for refusing to accept worse terms and conditions. So the threat is still there. The proposal to extend the minimum wage to British ferries might stop companies from paying £1.81 an hour, but it doesn't stop them from undercutting those workers who are earning more than the minimum wage. So the incentive is still there for them to replace existing workers. And the government's, I think that's the most important part of it. The government's plans do nothing to strengthen, of course they don't, do nothing to strengthen the power of trade unions to defend their members, whether that's through coordinated boycotts or secondary inaction. And I think the unfortunate thing for B&O is that they butted heads with a union that happens to be Milton and well organised and has played a blinder during this dispute, but that's not always going to be the case.
Yeah, that's very true. But I wanted to ask Alex very briefly there, because when we were up at the demo in line, you spoke to me, you said, look, this isn't a kind of, not that we saw this coming, but this isn't massively a surprise because it's been going on within the sector for decades. And that's what we're here today to talk about, is this flexibility of the labour market. And you talked to me about how this has already happened in the deep sea sector, and kind of ferry, the intra-country ferry system was almost the last bastion, if you like, of organised labour, because it's been attacked elsewhere, particularly in the deep sea sector.
Yes, so Sean just mentioned the UK government's proposal for a solution, which is not a solution as far as we're concerned, or as far as the workers we represent are concerned, which would be to insert a floor of the UK national minimum wage in the ferry sector. And obviously, if you're earning a professional salary, let's say, as a bosun or an engine room rating, or indeed a ship's officer, the attraction of going from £30,000 a year or more in the case of ships officers, considerably more, to a floor of a national minimum wage is not attractive at all. It's a huge attack on your pay and conditions. But we've been, as a union, campaign politically for the national minimum wage to be applicable in this sector, because incredibly, in the UK national minimum wage legislation that was brought in by the Labour government, under Blair, maritime workers were explicitly excluded from national minimum wage provisions. And we just saw that as being an outrageous exclusion, a discrimination, and something that needed to be corrected. And so we have been campaigning for the national minimum wage to apply. And the campaign was successful in the sense that in 2018, the Tory Secretary of State for Transport, Chris Grayling, inserted the national minimum wage on board vessels which operate between UK ports. That's why between Larne and Cairn Ryan, the UK national minimum wage has to apply, but it doesn't have to apply between Dover and Calais, because Grayling gave the ship owners a get-out clause, which was effectively that if they registered their vessels in a third territory, in Cyprus or in Liberia or wherever it might be, Bermuda, then the UK national minimum wage did not need to apply. And that is essentially the flag of convenience. Now, this is the situation, the massive legislative loophole that has operated in the deep sea sector, particularly since the 1970s. So from the 1970s onwards, you see the proliferation of these huge shipping firms based in the city of London or Athens using flags of convenience, which means that they register the ship, the vessel, in a third domain, a third territory. And initially, when flags of convenience started, those tended to be, you know, tax havens such as Bermuda, the Bahamas. They also used Liberia as a registration, a country of registration. So when you look up on a maritime register where the vessel is registered, which national authority has responsibility for the safety of that vessel, you'll see that it's registered in Liberia, a country very little in the way of a maritime regulatory agency or system, and certainly zero power to implement arrests on ships which are breaking maritime safety law. So that was the first move they did, was to register the vessels abroad. The second move really developed a pace in the 21st century, which was the use of agency labour, the widespread use of agency labour. So maritime crewing agencies have proliferated. There's a particular one based in Glasgow called Clyde Marine Services, which is used by P&O and some other ferry operators. And those maritime agencies have become targets for our campaign because they are a conduit for bringing in workers who are contracted on the basis of their country of origin. So they have an employment contract based in India, based in the Philippines, based in Ukraine, based in Latvia, Estonia, any low-wage economy you want to name. And those are the employment contracts on which they bring the workers in. Those are the rates of pay that those workers will earn applicable to their country of origin, not to the countries where they're working. Certainly not comparable to the level of pay of unionized ferry workers in the UK ferry sector. So it's a massive piece of social dumping. It initially started in the deep sea sector. It's now proliferating through the ferry sector. And we can see how that's happened in the last 20 years very clearly in Europe.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how that emerges everywhere at the same time over the last 20, 30 years in so many different industries, that flexible labour markets that allow fire and rehire. And of course, it is of course celebrated every day by most of our political parties, by orthodox economists who attack in the same breath, of course, worker protections. You know, when unions have too much bargaining power, where there are too many job protection laws, which makes it harder to fire workers, where unemployment benefits are too generous or run on. But those protections, of course, are part of, they're part, at least, I suppose, the product of a century of militant worker struggle as well, aren't they? And these protections are being slowly dismantled everywhere. I mean, it's kind of central, isn't it, Sean, to the neoliberal project, the flexibilization of labour, and as Alex has said, social dumping, getting workers in the West in particular to compete for employment with workers across the global South. And we know capital does that in two ways. It either outsources that labour, it shifts production to the global South, or it brings in cheap labour. It's kind of central. It's one of the backbones, isn't it, of that neoliberal project.
It is, yeah. And as you say, neoliberalism was really the set of practices or the strategy that the capitalist class adopted in the 1970s in an attempt to try to shore up profits and recapture some political power. And in the West, it's generally involved a number of different things. As you said, the relocation of production to countries where labour was cheapest, financialisation, privatisation, defunding of public services, public goods, welfare states, attacks on trade unions. Yes, a major pillar of this neoliberal project was the shift towards greater job insecurity. And it sort of began in the service sector. It was more prevalent in the service sector for a long time, but it spread to almost every industry and even to large parts of the public sector, where you now see agency staff employed in hospitals, in the civil service, in education, in all aspects of the public sector. And this insecure work includes everything from agency and casual work, 0 hours contracts, to bogus self-employment. And it's spread to such an extent that the estimate is now that there's 1 in 9 people in Britain and Ireland who are in this type of work. And it's often low paid, it's non-unionized, lacking in proper benefits. And the people in this type of employment are already struggling to keep their heads above water and are definitely going to be hit hardest by the cost of living crisis.
The other thing that's really clear on about the use of agency labour, particularly in the maritime sector, is that because the workers are all on one ship, you get this perfect microcosm of the imperialism of the labour market. So you will see the further that workers are brought from their home country to work, the lower they are paid. So you will see that typically UK ratings or seafarers domiciled and from Belfast, in Glasgow, in Liverpool, in other British ports are paid more and are undercut by workers from Eastern Europe, from the Baltic countries. And they themselves, workers from Eastern Europe, undercut yet again by workers from India, by workers from the Philippines. And essentially, the darker your skin, the less you get paid. And that is just so clear when you see what's going on with this process on board a single vessel, such as the P&O Ferries dispute that we're looking at now. Racism dripping from every single employment relation, really.
The interesting thing there that Sean said also is that there are sectors of work in society where you wouldn't think these things would be happening. Like if you'd have said 20 years ago, we'll see that flexibilization happen in this sector. But there's nowhere that's beyond it. That's the point, isn't it? If they can, as you said, socially dump or bring in cheap labor or get you to compete with other. I remember during the COVID, there was a discussion about, well, this is going to be great. We can all work from home and work on our computers and we can all sit at home and do our jobs on it. And I'm thinking, well, if you can do your job remotely, then so can someone in the global south. So you'll be competing very soon for that contract of work with a billion other workers across the globe. And that, of course, as you say, is how imperialism works, because that wage differential and the price of labour is central to how the system works and how the system is driven. One of the things that strikes me as really interesting here is how the debate's been shaped by the use of new language. I was talking to you the other day about this, Sean. And people keep talking about precarious work and the precariat and all this new language. But the idea that precarious work is kind of new is also a figment, isn't it? You know, I know the blue tick types and social commentators like to invent new words to kind of make themselves relevant, you know, and get books published. But shit working conditions and exploitation is hardly a new experience to workers under capitalism. Sean, you were talking about that the other day, that precariousness is a feature of workers historically under capitalism and globally today.
There's a book come out a few years ago on this by Guy Standen, and it pointed to the emergence of a precariat as a sort of described it as a new category of worker that sat underneath the what you might describe as the traditional working class, the old industrial worker. But what he's describing in the book, and it's interesting, but what he's describing is something that's been there in different forms throughout the history of capitalism. Precarity has always been a feature of employment under capitalism. Like, take one example, the turn of the 19th to the early 20th century, the dockers. So the dockers of Sailor Town in North Belfast had to come out of their homes at the crack of dawn and go and stand in a line and wait to see whether they had a day's work. And that was precarious. That was insecure work by definition. Capital has always depended on the existence of a reserve army of unemployed and underemployed workers to drive down conditions, force people to compete against each other. Stable employment as a concept is something that's relatively new. It's something that people have had to fight for. And it's never absolute. You know, there's always a degree of precarity and insecurity, even in the most stable jobs. But what it would say is there's no doubt that employment has generally become more precarious over the past 40 years. As we said, like, some sectors are more susceptible to precarious employment practices. So agriculture, for example, logistics and shipping, the service sector, but it's creeping into all sectors. And just to allude to something that Alex was talking about, one big change that we've seen over the neoliberal era, it's slightly different to previous eras, is that billions more people in the global south have been incorporated into the global workforce through globalization, through the outsourcing of production, through land dispossession that forces people who were subsisting themselves into employment. And very few of those people would be in what you would call secure employment. About 2 billion of them are in formal employment, which is below subsistence wages, dangerous working conditions, no social protections, no unionization, and no rights. And what has been happening in the global north is a deliberate strategy on the part of the capitalist class to force down wages, working conditions, and living standards to the level that exists or pertains in the global south. I think that's what's been happening over the last 40 years.
Yeah, because I was going to ask a question, where did that idea of, you know, stable employment or the job for life, I grew up in the 70s as a kid, and I remember you grew up with that idea, didn't you? You would be something, you would, you know, do well at school or you'd study or you get an apprenticeship and you'd become something that you would be for the rest of your life. And we've kind of been spoiled by that notion, Alex, a little bit, haven't we? The idea that we're going to have a job for life, and the only reason why that existed, now, yes, it was based on militant worker struggle, but it was also because we lived and were employed in the imperialist court.
Yeah, there were a number of reasons why there are a number of explanations for this brief period, whatever you want to call it, the Keynesian golden age or something, let's say between 1945 and 1975 or something like that. You know, one is the fact that you had a highly unionized, organized working class in some countries in the West. The other one was the existence of an alternative social system in the Soviet Union, which meant that employers in the West, imperialists in the West, could couldn't take the working class for granted. They had to buy them off because there was an alternative social system in existence that dominated a third of the world and arguably more as the national liberation struggles of the 1960s and 70s began to take effect. So there was a real sense in which capitalists couldn't take workers for granted. Of course, what's happened since you were a kid was that the Soviet Union has ceased to exist, and that pressure, you know, which was exerted on the capitalist world, disappeared. And as a result, employers in the West have felt that there is simply no need for this class compromise, which they'd taken part in for 30 years. And so they've gone back to capitalism red in tooth and claw. And that's, you know, what we saw with Thatcher. That's what we've seen with numerous British governments in the 1990s and ever since. So we have to understand where that class compromise came from. It came from a particular moment in history, which isn't going to repeat itself. What it means for us now, I think, ideas such as the precariat, I think are profoundly divisive. Others who use the term are describing the casualized working class. And that's nothing new. And what were Larkin and Connolly doing in Belfast in 1909? They were organising a casualised working class in the great dock strike, the carters and the dockers. That was where the Irish Transport General Workers Union came from, was the need to have an organisation of the unorganised workers whom many British trade union leaders said couldn't be organised until Larkin and Connolly came along and proved them wrong. So there's nothing new about the what is being described by the term the precariat, but the use of the term, I think, is a deliberate attempt to create fractions within the working class, to persuade at least whoever uses the term the precariat, to persuade people through the use of ideological use of language that working class unity is not a relevant concept, that there are deep fissures between the super exploited sections of the class in what we used to call the developing world and, if you like, the traditional organized working class in the West, and that those two groups do not have a common interest. So it's an ideological term that needs to be demolished.
It's interesting you say that, because I would argue that that idea of that kind of split in the working class has found its way actually into the thinking of some of the labour movement. Oh, we couldn't possibly organise that sector. We couldn't possibly organise those kinds of workers because they're too precarious. Now, we can't go in there and do that. Would it be true to say that's affected some thinking in the labour movement about who's easier to organise than others? Because there's no doubt that the modern world of work is the more difficult place to organise, because you have this fragmentation of employment structures. You know, we've seen it through, like, you know, the Deliveroo drivers, and we've seen it through the kind of those these new disruptor unions emerging, that sometimes big unions have just said, not given up, that's too strong maybe, but they've said, look, we can't organise this. So have they bought into that ideology?
Well, I couldn't possibly comment on what unions who've failed to organise Deliveroo might have bought into. But I do think you're right that there's been an attempt to sell a concept to the traditional organised working class in Western Europe. There's been an attempt to sell an ideological concept. They are insiders, and that workers from the global south who are being super exploited in the global value chain by Western companies in order to make super profits, that those workers from the global south are outsiders. And that the insiders have got a common interest with the companies that are exploiting them to preserve their terms and conditions and their privileges from the outsiders. That's a project that's been going on through the European Union and through other supranational bodies for over a decade. I mean, do you remember the term flexicurity? I can distinctly remember about 15, 20 years ago, the European Commission coming out with this ridiculous word, flexicurity, which was an attempt to obviously bolt the idea of flexible labour market onto some concept of social security. And there were huge research papers written about flexicurity, how you could combine a flexible labour market model with certain guarantees for social and employment security, but only for those people who were EU citizens, and only for certain EU citizens. So it was a very selective model. Now, I think what's happened with the proliferation of the Deliveroos and the job agencies and the pop-up competitors is that attempt to build a fake consensus within the EU institutions and within the labour movement around insiders and the benefits of flexicurity, that's just fallen apart because the market has ripped it apart. You can't pretend that there's some kind of job security or economic security or social security which provides a floor for workers who are riding a moped round or a bicycle or an electric bike around cities delivering curries and pizzas for a living on the end of an app. It's just not credible. It doesn't work. So the market has just ripped that whole conceit, that whole deceitful act of language, ideas such as flexicurity apart. And I don't see it being restored because essentially there isn't a social democratic core left anymore within Western Europe that would get behind protection of labour rights and protection of social rights sufficiently strongly in order to give it meaning. The neoliberals have won politically, and they've just ripped the legs out from any attempt to protect the welfare state or employment rights or social rights. Now, from the point of view of trade unions, they're having to, certainly in Britain, trade unions, even those affiliated to the Labour Party, are having to consider that that political project is probably not got legs anymore in terms of political aims.
Yeah, when you think back to the, as you said, the golden period of capitalism, the welfare compromise of the 50s and 60s, the working class institutions that emerged then, including the protections and the idea of having good, decent employment and pensions and all the rest of it, when they emerged, they also emerged, of course, with strong, as you said, militant labour struggle. And it required, even within the context of having an alternative system in the Soviet Union, it required much stronger and more confrontational labour movement, even then, to push those things through. So, Sean, the question to both of you. Sean first, what kind of labour movement do we need now, considering we don't have that alternative system as a kind of warning, if you like, to capital to compromise with labour? And considering we've been under attack for 30 or 40 years, is the labour movement, Sean, in a position where it's ready to confront capital in any serious way?
Yeah, I think you'd be right in saying that the trade union movement is much weaker than it was in the 1970s. I think that's indisputable. But I think there's a recognition, certainly amongst some of the unions in Britain and Ireland, of the need and the opportunities to rebuild in the workplace and the organised resistance in communities. And that's going to become ever more important in response to the cost of living crisis, which is only going to escalate. The absence of that political pull of attraction and that political force to orient yourself around. So I think the role of the trade union has become ever more important into the future. And I think the unions recognise that.
Are we in a position? Are we in a considering the assault that's taken place over the last 30 years, considering none of the Thatcherite anti-trade union laws in Britain and in the north of Ireland, at least, have been, that our hands have been tied politically in so many different ways compared to people? When you speak to young trade unions today and tell them what we were able to do in the past in terms of having a political kind of program as well as an industrial one, they look at you in disbelief. And we're a long way from that, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are a long way from having a political programme. The biggest drawback that workers face in Britain and Ireland is the fact that they don't have a political party that operates at a level of state power that is able to put forward a political programme that it has workers' interests embedded in it. So what we're doing at the moment around the P&O dispute is our union and the other union that's involved, Nautilus International, which is the ship's officers' union, we're in fairly advanced discussions with ferry operators in the UK ferry sector. So these are P&O's competitors, about creating a framework, a labour employment rights framework, which would cover wages and employment conditions and training. We're fairly confident that we're going to get an agreement across the ferry sector, which the UK government is going to make mandatory for ferry operators. And we're going to be using that really to pull the rug out from under P&O's flexible business model. It's also going to affect Irish ferries, who operate ferries between Dover and Calais, as well as between Irish ports and the European mainland. And it's worthwhile, I think, just recapping on where this whole downward spiral started in the ferry sector in terms of Irish Ferries' role, because this didn't start with P&O. I think it's very instructive to just look at what happened with some of the other ferry operators 20 years ago. But the first ferry operator to really pioneer the model that P&O are attempting to deploy now, this flexible, low-wage, globalised business model, was a Finnish ferry company that operates ferries between Finland and Estonia, a company called Viking Line. And in 2003, they sacked their Finnish seafarers on a vessel called the MV Rosella and replaced them with Estonian seafarers paid at about a third of the wage of Finnish seafarers. And the Finnish Seafarers Union took strike action, called on the International Transport Workers Federation, the global union federation that they're affiliated to, my union is also affiliated to take action as well. And the company, the ferry company Viking Line, as well as replacing the seafarers, had also flagged out its vessels to Estonia. So the following year, in 2003, or the following year after they'd done the flagging out, Estonia became one of the new accession countries that joined the European Union in 2004. And in 2004, Viking Line took the International Transport Workers Federation to the High Court in London, suing it for restraint of trade because it had been encouraging other affiliates not to come to agreements to allow Viking Line to operate its ferries. Now, the key legal point that that case turned on was Article 43 of the Fundamental Treaty of the European Union, which is an article that protects something called freedom of establishment, the right of a company that is based in the European Union or based in an EU member state to establish itself in any other EU member state. So the right of a company to open up an office in any other EU country and to operate under that country's laws within the European Union. And what Viking Line were claiming successfully was that the EU constitution allowed them to relocate their vessels to Estonia, to relocate their employment contracts to Estonia and to operate under Estonian law. And this went to the European Court of Justice, and the Viking Line case is quite famous. But the European Court found in favour of Viking Line and found that their right to relocate their vessels and their crews to low-wage countries was protected by the European Constitution. So that's where it started in the modern European context. Irish Ferries then followed them the following year in 2005. And Irish Ferries, I think it was the SIPTU initially discovered that there were Latvian seafarers working on board the MV Normandy operating between Dunleary and ports in northern France. And the Latvian seafarers were being paid less than a pound or less than a euro an hour. And it was SIPTU and the Irish Seafarers Union which rang the bell and called the alarm on that. And that led to a dispute in Irish Ferries, which took place in December in 2005 in Dublin with almost 100,000 workers on it protesting about this race to the bottom for Irish seafarers. But given the social partnership arrangements within Ireland, a deal was imposed by the social partnership regulatory agencies, which effectively gave Irish Ferries the wage cuts it wanted. And that has then directly led to the P&O dispute 15 years later, because in 2020, Irish Ferries were given slots to operate ferries between Dover and Calais. And that was seen by various neoliberals in the British government as being an excellent initiative that would bring in a low-cost operator who would create efficiencies in the sector. And lo and behold, a year and a half later, 800 people were made redundant at a moment's notice and taken off their vessels by balaclava-wearing security guards. So that's the narrative, that is the thread that follows, the neoliberal thread that goes between all of these different ferry operators driving the race to the bottom. And from our point of view, what we're seeking to do is to create an agreement between employers who don't see that business model as being viable for their business. And there are many of them, including, for example, in Scotland, where you'd have the Caledonian McBrayne and the Northlink ferry operations, which operate lifeline ferry services that operate between all of the Hebridean, Shetland and Orkney Islands and the mainland of Scotland. In those cases, those ferry services depend on local employment, people having decent wages that can sustain their families. So it's important to remember that the capitalist class doesn't operate as a homogenous class. There are fractions within it, and we need to try to widen those fractions.
Yeah, thanks very much for that. I'm going to get Alex back on again, Sean. What do you reckon? Because he put the boot into both social partnership and the European Union there quite succinctly, and I was quite pleased with that, because I'm sure Alex spent an awful lot of time on social media over the last month explaining lunatic Romaniacs that the sacking of 800 P&O workers has nothing to do with Brexit, and in fact, not only do their rights are not protected under European Union law, the Viking case, if anyone chooses to go and read about the Viking case Alex so articulately laid out before us there, shows what happens to workers' rights within the European Union. There's an awful lot of people who should consult with that. I think we'll stick it up on our social media, Sean, access to reading about the Viking and the Laval cases. And thanks also, Alex, for putting a boot into social partnership there. That's always very welcome when we've got listening to an Irish audience. Lads, I'm gonna leave it there. Our time is up. Thanks very much for your contributions today. If anyone wants to access all of these podcasts, they're part of Left Bloc Patreon. Feel free to sign up, where you'll get access to The Week at Work, to Nuala Nog, an Irish language podcast, and the ABCs of Green Politics as well. There's four podcasts on that platform. And you're very welcome. And we'll see you all again soon.
That was Trademark Belfast, and you are fucking marvellous. If you have a few quid, support the Left Bloc Media Patreon If you don't, just listen in. Up the workers and slang a foil.